Today is World Food Day, and this week some of the world's most innovative thinkers in the battle against hunger are gathered in Des Moines for the World Food Prize Symposium. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk about the foundations of sustainable development and what it will really take to feed the world with scientist, author, and humanitarian Louise Fresco and Per Pinstrup Andersen, World Food Prize laureate from 2001. It is also our fall membership drive, and if you value what you hear on Iowa Public Radio, it's time to make an investment. iowapublicradio.org. Thank you. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today is World Food Day, observed every year since 1981. This is a day set aside to focus on the problem of hunger around the globe. And this week, some of the most innovative thinkers in the fight against hunger are gathered in Des Moines for the World Food Prize Symposium. This hour, we're going to talk about the foundations of sustainable development and what it really will take to feed the world. With me today is Louise Fresco. She's a scientist, an author, a humanitarian. She's a professor at the University of Amsterdam and former director of research and assistant director general for the agriculture at the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. Hello, Louise.
Good morning, Charity. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And also with us in the studio today is Per Pinstrup Andersen. He is a World Food Prize laureate from 2001. He's also a former director general of the International Food Policy Research Institute and the H.E. Babcock Professor of Food and Nutrition at Cornell University. Hello, Per.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure.
And of course, hunger is a problem we've been talking about for a very long time. I want to talk about hunger today, right now in 2013. Louise, as you talk with others who are working so hard to fight this problem, what do you see as the most pressing issues today?
Well, I think it's good to say that we have made remarkable strides in solving the issue of hunger. Hunger and poverty are closely related because if you are poor, you cannot afford to buy food. And when you are poor, you often don't have the energy also to grow it. Now, the wonderful thing that people should realize is that a lot of the poverty issues and the food shortages can be solved. And in fact, the marvelous thing is in the last 20 years, we have been able to lift about 1 billion people out of poverty, thanks to efforts by all kinds of countries. Now, however, the next 100 million or hundreds of million will be more difficult. Why? Because hunger often occurs in areas that are very poorly governed, where there is civil strife, such as in the Eastern Congo, for example, or Somalia, or where people have been displaced. But there is also, of course, increasingly hunger in urban areas. We used to think that all the hunger was in poor, disadvantaged rural areas, but now there is also increasingly hunger in the cities. And when we say hunger in the cities, there are two key issues there. One is people need to have purchasing power to buy food, because if you live in the city, you cannot grow food yourself. So that means overall economic development. And it also means growing food in the rural areas. And as the rural areas become less and less populated, at least relatively so, we definitely need to produce more per unit of land, but also per unit of labor and per unit of water, for example. So sustainable efficiency is really the key challenge for solving the food problem. And that takes different forms in different areas. But for example, if you have areas where the holdings are very small, you cannot mechanize easily like you could do in Iowa. So we need appropriate sort of technologies to overcome the different constraints that different people have in different areas. That's why it's a complicated problem. But I want your readers and listeners to understand that we also have made progress. It's not a sort of black box where we don't know what to do and there is no progress. Fortunately, we have learned our lessons from the past.
Well, and Per, you have said that the world can produce enough food to feed our growing population, but it's global food policies and politics that are the major impediments. What do you see as the greatest obstacles to overcome right now in 2013?
No, I think you're absolutely right. The big problem is that governments don't take hunger alleviation sufficiently seriously. They have other objectives to deal with, and I'm talking, of course, about developing countries. Imagine that you're in a room with 100 people and that group is representative of the world population. Then 11 of these 100 will be hungry. Another 20, meaning roughly one-third of those in that room, will be undernourished. They won't have enough, get access to enough nutrients. And then another 15 or so, some of which would be duplicates, of course, would be overweight and obese. We got a very serious problem with access to food and access to the right kind of food. But there is a lot of food in the world. It's just not available to these many people who go hungry or who are malnourished. So the big problem, and it relates back to what governments are doing, but it also relates back to what the private sector is doing. We need the two sectors to work together to make sure that people actually have access to all of this food that is out there. Right now, there is so much food in stock in so many countries, but poor people can't get access to it.
We, right now, in this country, we have a growing movement focusing on local foods and sustainable agriculture. Of course, there are many different kinds of agriculture in this country, and that is a small part of agriculture in this country. Louise, I've seen your TED Talk from a few years ago, and I know that this is a subject that interests you a great deal. What do you think is important for us who love the idea of eating locally, to understand about the implications of that?
Well, let me first say that I'm very happy that there is a movement to think about food issues locally, because the reason why we have such trouble in dealing with food in many, many countries is that there is an increasing disconnect between urban people and middle classes and the rural areas. People do not remember anymore where their food comes from. There are now 2-3 generations who have no agricultural route. So the local food movement is wonderful in the sense that it restores some of the linkages between producer and consumer. However, we shouldn't overestimate the importance that local food production can give you. If you think about Iowa, if you would go exclusively local, there would be no oranges, no coffee, no tea, no rice, no tomatoes, and a lot of other things. And certainly in wintertime, you would have very little choice. The tomatoes, you might have them in summer. And it's good to realize that only a few generations back, the dietary variety of people were very, very poor. So that's the one thing. So local is good in terms of awareness, but it cannot feed us entirely. And of course, if you think of big cities, take, for example, Mexico City, where we have 20 million people, there is no way in which you can feed the population of such a city with the surrounding neighborhoods, just the rural areas outside Mexico City. I think in general, from a technical point of view, and Per can correct me from the economics, you would think that you would best grow the food there where the land is most suitable, where the climate is most suitable. Of course, we shouldn't and we cannot ship food around all over the world. And I understand very well this desire to remain close to home. But there are definitely things that cannot be done locally. And hence, we should also be grateful for the wonderful interconnectedness that we have thanks to a world market that allows us to eat avocados and strawberries in winter. Now, the thing I would like your listeners to think about is there is no formal objection to eating strawberries in wintertime, for example. But it's good to remember that when you eat strawberries in wintertime and you live in Iowa, that is something special that was not available to you only a few generations ago. So there needs to be an awareness also in how we eat. And the local food movement in that sense has really contributed to that awareness.
You also caution people to think about the privilege that they have, not just in eating fruits and vegetables that are out of season, but in eating food that is prepared and grown locally.
Yes, I think it is a privilege to have the choice between the local and something that comes from far away. But people should be aware that our privilege is that we can spend most of our times on doing other things. And only a few generations ago, most people had to work nearly all day to either earn the money or to actually work the land in order to feed themselves. The fact that we are now, that agriculture and its efficiency has freed us up to be confident of the fact that we can do other things and that there will be food for us tomorrow on the table, that's an enormous privilege. And I regret that in many countries like the United States, the sense of privilege that it's not, you know, it's historically quite unique that we can be confident that we'll be good and safe food on the table tomorrow. That sense of privilege needs to be restored a little more.
Do you think there's a danger in romanticizing the small producer, the small baker feeding the community bread? Do you think that, and we do tend to romanticize that more and more, I think.
Well, I think like everybody, I'm sensitive to sort of this nostalgia about the past being better than the present. But of course, the reality of the past or the reality of the baker, for example, was that the poor baker would get up at 2 a.m, would work very hard to mix the dough and often had disease problems as a result because he worked in a very hot and stuffy environment. And the realities of this nostalgia of doing things by hand, of course, were not very nice at all. Most farmers were old by the time they were 50. So I understand this nostalgia as a counterweight to our urban lifestyle, but we should not romanticize something that wasn't really as good as we think it is. Now, the challenge for us is, on the one hand, to find the appropriate scale of intensification. You don't want Iowa farmers to go back to growing things by hand. That's impossible. But at the same time, you want to make room for this desire to look at the local and look at things done by hand. But most people need to be aware of the fact that most of the bread, even if it comes from a local bakery, actually has been already pre-mixed and is not the bread that we ate 100 years ago, and actually tastes much better and is more nutritious. So modernization has brought us also a lot of positive things, and romanticizing it to the extent that people want to really go back to the past, I think is indeed dangerous because it blocks progress.
Per, do you think that there is a danger right now in people talking so much about these traditional ways of producing food?
No, I think the real danger is if we don't let people have the choice. So if in fact people want to buy what's locally produced, I think that's the choice they should have. But we should not try to tell the rest of the world that they should also consume only what's produced locally. Look, I grew up on a 50-acre farm. I got up at 6 or sometimes earlier in the morning to milk the cows, feed the pigs, and then I went to the field for the rest of the day. It was not terribly romantic. It really wasn't. So we got to be real careful that we don't sit back in an armchair thinking that small-scale agricultural production is a wonderful thing. If it were, a lot more people would be doing it. I think we need, and I agree with Louise on that as well, we need to focus on producing the food where it can be produced at the lowest cost, because we need to keep the costs down so that low-income people can get access to the food that they need. And if we take the local food argument too far, what is Iowa State going to do with all of the corn it produces and all of the pork it produces? If nobody wants to buy it, they all want to produce their own food locally. So I think we still need trade. We need to exchange food between those areas where it's produced more efficiently and those areas where it's consumed. And one other point, in developing countries, people are moving from rural to urban areas very, very quickly. They are going to need food in these urban areas that they themselves cannot produce. So, yes, we have to maintain a balance and a choice between producing for local consumption and producing for consumption maybe halfway around the world. The argument that the impact on global warming from exporting food over long distances misses the point that the emission of greenhouse gases in transportation is an extremely small part of the emission of greenhouse gases in production. So if we can produce in a place where less CO2 is emitted to the soil, to the air, then that is what we should be doing, it seems to me, from a climate change perspective.
But in shipping that food across the world, then we run into those barriers that you were talking about earlier with food policy issues.
Well, but if it's cheaper, if somebody in a developing country who has very little money to spend on food or anything else can get it, corn cheaper from where it's produced most efficiently, I believe governments would support that. But yeah, you're right. Government policies need to be adjusted.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back to continue this conversation in a few minutes. We're talking about feeding the world this hour with two of the most innovative thinkers in this problem, in this fight against hunger around the world. With me is Per Pinstrup Andersen. He is a World Food Prize laureate from 2001, and Louise Fresco, a scientist, author, and humanitarian. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today is World Food Day, and we are spending this hour talking about hunger around the world, talking about some of the ways that people are fighting our hunger problem and some of the big issues that face us in the future as our world population grows. This week, some of the most innovative thinkers in the fight against hunger are gathered in Des Moines for the World Food Prize Symposium. And with me today, I have Louise Fresco. She's a scientist, author, and humanitarian. She's also a professor at the University of Amsterdam and former director of research and assistant director general for agriculture at the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. She'll also be speaking this afternoon at 4:15 at Grinnell, a lecture called World Food Day, the Next Decade. Also with me is Per Pinstrup Andersen. He is a World Food Prize laureate from 2001 and a former director general of the International Food Policy Research Institute and the H.E. Babcock Professor of Food and Nutrition at Cornell University. He'll be giving his lecture, Enough Food for All Forever, What Will It Take?, tomorrow morning at 10:45 at Grandview University in Des Moines. And Per, just before the break, we were talking about the importance of growing food in the places where it can be grown most efficiently. And of course, there have been very significant changes over the years to how much aid is given to places where there are serious hunger problems and the kind of aid that is given to places where there are serious hunger problems. And there's a lot of debate over what kind of aid is most effective. Give us your take. What kind of aid should the United States and other countries that can afford to help be giving to places where they just can't seem to grow enough food?
Well, first and foremost, we should assist developing countries improve the productivity in agriculture and in the supply chain between agriculture and the consumer. If poor people are to escape poverty and hunger, they have to be able to get access to less expensive food and higher incomes. We get less expensive food by investing in research that will reduce the cost of producing each unit of food. The reason we have more food per person in the world today than we did 50 years ago is that these kinds of investments in research were actually made. The Green Revolution and other research efforts have been very, very successful in increasing food production and reducing the cost of producing food per unit produced. So that would be priority number one. Priority number two would be to assist those countries that are confronted with acute problems, earthquakes, flooding, whatever it may be, and give them money so, in fact, they can go and buy the food they need. And if they can't get access to food, we may have to send them food aid. But my preference is to send cash to non-governmental organizations and let them buy the food in those countries, where developing countries, where food is available. So those will be the two priorities. But I believe the most critical part really is to invest in research. Now, let me add one other thing. If you help farmers produce more, but they cannot sell it because the local markets don't function or because they can't get access to fertilizers at reasonable prices and they can't get access to the other inputs that they need, it doesn't help much to tell a small farmer, you just need to double your production and everything would be fine, because they can't sell what they don't eat themselves, so they can buy the things that they can't produce. So much more investment needs to be made in what we normally refer to as rural infrastructure. And that means roads and irrigation facilities. It means primary education, primary health care, the kinds of things that only governments will pay for, because the private sector can't capture the benefits from those investments, but society can. With those investments made by governments in developing countries, and we can support them, the private sector can then function. And let's make no mistake, unless the private sector functions well in developing countries, people will not escape poverty and hunger. It's not a matter of public or private sector. It is a matter of both of them, each of them doing the job that it is that they are supposed to do.
Louise, I want to give you an opportunity to weigh in on that as well. And you know, there, of course, are many conversations going on about the best way to fight hunger around the world. Can you give us your insight on what you think the priorities need to be?
I definitely agree with Per. These are, you know, the things we know that work. I think, however, there are a couple of sort of embellishments that I could give. One is that we now think not just in terms of production, but really the entire food chain from, you know, from the soil to the plate, from farm to fork, I say, you say in English. And it's important to realize that as cities grow, people eat more and more processed foods also by the food industry. And in that process, from going to the farm to the consumer, a lot of food is lost nowadays. In fact, we think that maybe up to 40% of the food that is grown actually does not reach the plate. And there are many things we can do to reduce that, because it's a major inefficiency. Let me give you one simple example where everything ties together. That, for example, when you look at tomatoes, tomatoes are grown in West Africa, and about 3/4 of the tomatoes grown do not reach the consumer because they spoil, they rot beforehand. Why do they rot? Because on the one hand, genetically, the tomatoes that we grow there are not very resistant to transportation. They, you know, they get damaged and then a fungus starts to grow and they rot. But also because the transportation is slow, they are out in the sun, they're not stored properly, they stay outside the consumer's home, people have no refrigeration, etc., etc. So in fact, what we see now more than before is that we need to intervene not just at the farm level, but at all the stages in between. And that is really new. And it's the interesting thing about the tomatoes in West Africa, for example, is also that they take so long to reach the cities because very often they're kept for days at border checks because you know, countries don't want to let them in. So there is this whole policy issue or these customs barriers as well. Now, the interesting thing, I think, for Iowa, and since we're on Iowa Public Radio, I think, is to realize that what we have here in Iowa is a system of production, of communication also between farmers and the large private sector and the government, which in itself is a model of how things can be done. So what we need to bring to developing countries is not just our knowledge about genetics or about fertilizers or even about cold chains or policy, but it's also this way of communicating between farmers and consumers, between the private sector and the public sector. It's we're really talking about a sort of round table where together with communities we need to think about the best way to grow our food and the best way to consume it. And I think there in Iowa you have a unique system, or in many ways something that in itself is, if you want, a kind of export product.
Let me ask you, I want to go back to this idea of local food in the United States. And again, this is a growing movement in Iowa. And Per, you were talking about the importance of research into food production. I'm wondering if this is kind of a unique opportunity, because in Iowa, there are more and more small farms now. And of course, that is still a small percentage of the kind of agriculture we do here. And it will remain a small percentage for a long time of the kind of agriculture we do here. But of course, even these very small farms are using modern technology and are more mechanized and are depending on scientific research to get to maximize their yield for the amount of land that they have. I wonder if that kind of focus in the United States and in Iowa on growing the kinds of foods that can be eaten locally, that don't necessarily have to be transported that far, I wonder if that could be an area where there could be a lot learned that could be shared with developing nations. Per?
I think there's absolutely no doubt that you're right on that. Developing countries can learn a lot from what we've done in the United States and Europe with respect to smallholder farming. We have a tendency to talk about the United States and developing countries as two separate entities that one can't really learn from the other. And that, of course, is wrong. So, yes, I believe that is correct. And if you look at smallholder farmers in developing countries, they are, in fact, producing both for themselves and for the local community. They sell whatever surplus they have in the village close by. So much of what is being consumed now in those countries is locally produced. And if we could help them improve the productivity, reduce the cost of production, produce more, produce the kind of food that is needed to meet nutrition requirements, then I believe we made tremendous headway. So, yes, I think they can learn a lot from what's going on in Iowa.
We're talking Louise?
Your comment here, because I would like to know whether those small farms indeed are viable. Most smallholders that I know actually do not necessarily want to remain smallholders. There needs to be a sort of a minimum size, and that differs according to state or even a location, for which you have a decent income when you are a farmer. That's very important. And again, what I said earlier, I cannot see how smallholders alone can feed a city like Mexico City with 20 million inhabitants. So the answer is not whether we need smallholders or large-scale farmers. It's to get the optimal scale depending on the location.
Well, I want to mention that you're welcome to join our conversation this hour at 866-780-9100. My guests right now are Louise Fresco, scientist, author, and humanitarian. Per Pinstrup is a World Food Prize laureate from 2001. And they will also be willing to answer your questions at 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Louise, I want to follow up on that as well. You mentioned how when people move from the rural areas to the cities, they tend to eat more produced foods or processed foods. Mm-hmm. There are other changes to diets around the world that are taking place as well. And one of those is that animal protein is a bigger and bigger part of diets around the world. You see that as a problem.
Absolutely. People in cities, as they get more income, will basically eat more refined foods, meaning also more sugar, and especially more animal proteins, mostly from either chickens or pork or increasingly also fish proteins. Now, this is a very logical development, which has very strong historical and even biological roots. Proteins are very important, and it must be said, in meat or fish, what you find is not just proteins, but also minerals that are extremely important. Is this a problem? Not at the levels what we're talking about in a country like China. Yes, it is complicated for a country like China to produce its the feed that is necessary to feed these animals, and that's why countries like the United States and Brazil are producing, in fact, more feed than food for export sometimes. But I think there is no way in which we could stop the development of increased animal production and increased animal consumption up to a level that is in accordance with the overall dietary and health norms. Definitely a level of protein consumption or meat consumption as we have here in the United States or in parts of Europe or Argentina is so high that that is not only unsustainable in terms of production, but also has some major or can have major health effects. I think this development will stabilize itself. We, apart from dietary changes, one of the big things we can do nowadays is that we can find substitutes for animal proteins, for example, from vegetable proteins, or even perhaps in the future think of alternatives like algae and insects. In fact, most of the meat that people eat is processed in some form. It's in a sauce or it's not a steak. It's processed meat. And if you substitute up to 30% of vegetable proteins in animal proteins, in fact, the consumer doesn't even notice it. So our solution for the protein crave that we have as a world population will be sustainable production on the one hand, going for greater efficiencies, and the efficiencies of fish and poultry are already very high, and looking for substitution so that we can keep animal proteins affordable at levels at which they are required for a healthy population.
Well, and Per, you also have spoken a great deal about the link between health and food production around the world. What are some of the issues that we may be missing when we talk about hunger that we need to be focusing on?
I think the real big issue here is, can we help people have access to a mixed diet? That diet may or may not include animal source food. I'm less worried about that. Vegetarians are doing quite well as well. People who eat animal source foods are doing okay as long as they don't eat too much fat and too much sugar. And that gets us to the processed foods problem. What we are seeing developing in many countries now, particularly among poor people, is that they become obese because they are eating too much dietary energy, too many calories. And many of these calories are empty. They don't have nutrients. So you have people who become obese and they are deficient in minerals and vitamins. So in effect, we are seeing both of these problems developing in the same persons. What I think we need in the food system is a diversification of our efforts so that we don't continue to focus almost exclusively on the basic grains, that is corn, wheat, and rice. They provide the very, very large share of the calories that people consume. We need to focus much more on improving productivity in various vegetables, various fruits, so that we, and in some cases in animal source foods as well, so that we can help low-income people get access to a mixed diet at a price they can afford. And there's a lot we can do in the food system to make that happen. But I agree with Louise that a lot of what has to be done is post-harvest. It's in the supply chain. It's in the process after the food leaves the farm and before it hits the consumer. There is a lot of sweetener and sugar and fat added to these processed foods. And when you talk to the processing corporations about this, they say, well, but that's what the consumer wants. And when you talk to the consumers who, in the meantime, became obese and undernourished, they say, well, that's what's available and that is what is cheap. So you got to somehow deal with this vicious cycle here, because if the consumer really wanted nutritious food, the industry will produce it. We've seen many examples on that. So it's not as though there is a good guy and a bad guy in this business, but we somehow have to break that vicious cycle, because otherwise we're all going to be obese and undernourished, and that is exactly what we want to avoid.
Well, I want to take a look into the future. I know, Louise, your talk at Grinnell this afternoon is focusing on the next decade of World Food Day. And World Food Day every year has a particular focus. Usually it's about agriculture. What do you see in the next decade as the places where we need to focus and we need to start global conversations?
Well, I definitely agree with Per that food quality is a very important dimension. And here is, by the way, also something that governments need to talk about by, for example, setting standards. It's a complicated issue because you cannot just reduce salt or sugar in one go because people are used to certain tastes and this takes a longer term process. But one area we haven't mentioned that yet, and which I think is of great importance, especially in a globalized world, that is food safety, i.e. the risk of contamination or of substances, including pathogens, disease-causing insects or viruses or bacteria in the food chain. Now, it's not necessarily true that if the food chain is longer, i.e. geographically longer, that you have more risk. The risk is not in the length, but in the lack of visibility of all the people or all the companies involved. And in the past, of course, a pig was slaughtered on the farm and people knew who slaughtered the pig, and it might not have been very hygienic, but it was a kind of visibility of the process. Today, pigs may be slaughtered in Poland, processed in some way in another European country, come to the US or vice versa, and nobody knows actually who has been involved and what has been happening. And although there is some documentation, I think we can do a lot better in creating some long-term loyalties and visibility in the food chain. And we're helped very much by information technology that could allow us to, in principle, know about every single batch of food that moves in this complex worldwide food chain, where it comes from, who has been tampering with it, or who has been involved. And this also helps the consumer to identify more with the food. So I think that the transparency in the food chain is something that really requires a lengthy conversation and will be attractive both to farmers and to consumers. To give you one small example, I own a little woolen shirt that was given to me, and it has one of these QR codes. And when I type in the number on the internet, I can actually see a picture of the farm where the sheep were grazing, and I see a conversation of the farmer with his son. And I see also the factory that has been actually spinning the wool and so on. And that gives a tremendous sense of ownership and a commitment from the consumer to the production process. If we apply this also to food safety issues, I think we'll also entice the consumer in behaving safely him or herself. Because with food safety, it's not just the companies that have a responsibility. A lot of the food safety risks are also just on your kitchen sink, you know, mixing vegetable foods with foods from animal origin, not using the right refrigeration, and so on and so forth. So it's everybody in the food chain that needs to be involved. But it makes for great conversation pieces around the dining table.
Well, Louise, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we're going to have to let that be the final word today. Louise Fresco is a scientist, author, and humanitarian. She'll be speaking this afternoon at 4:15 at Grinnell, talking about World Food Day, the next decade. And Per, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Per Pinstrup Anderson is a World Food Prize laureate from 2001. He is also the H.E. Babcock Professor of Food and Nutrition at Cornell University. He'll be speaking tomorrow as part of the World Food Prize Symposium at 10:45 in the morning at Grandview University. His lecture is Enough Food for All Forever. What Will It Take? This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.